about to enter a new dimension of experience. You will venture to a place beyond imagination, where both space and time deform into grotesque realities.
Here is the actual sound of a person who's just finished dining at Kingston's Seaway Restaurant.
Hello. Hello, baby. Hello.
Wow. You're some operator.
I was born in a basement in 1959.
Editor's note. No filter or increase in tape speed were used for these scenes.
Without you as the liaison between McDonald's Corporation and the customer, we're dead.
A free candy bar for every child that knows what grows in the secret garden. The answer, of course, is love, hope, and happiness.
Thank you for letting us introduce you to one of the finest entertainment products available, and happy motoring.
WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. Hello, time travelers. Derek Gary sitting in for Chris Earle this Wednesday evening. 855-915-WMFO remains the telephone number. The only thing that's changed is the host. I've piloted my blue box into the station, and I'm about to get on board and take us back to the year 1982. The whole show tonight, we're going to be in the year 1982, celebrating the 35th anniversary of what was actually a pretty landmark year for music and movies. And for the movies part of things, I have got a real treat for you guys. This is the kind of thing that you never, ever, ever, ever hear on the radio anymore. This is the Source Summer Cinema Spectacular from 1982. Riches and Rubenstein Productions put this together to get people on the radio excited about all of the movies coming to theaters that summer. And there's a couple of really, really big ones in here. So we'll be listening to that a little bit later. I've also got a whole ton of songs from 1982. And let me tell you, 1982 musically is a fascinating year. Because the only thing that's really dead at that point is disco. Disco is dead. Disco is over. Disco is done. But there is still stadium rock. There is still a lot of what we consider classic rock today. The punk movement is in full swing, and the new wave has just begun. So you have all these different musical styles that are lighting things up on the radio. Freeform radio is in full effect, and it's all over the dial from coast to coast, not just in a couple of little oddball corners like WMFO in Medford. And we're going to start off tonight with one of the more iconic songs from 1982. This is one of the early new wave hits of the 1980s. It is a song that you will recognize from movies, video games. Anything set in the 1980s is going to call back to this. And this is the extended version. So sit back, relax, and join us in the year 1982.
Yeah. Yeah. Blue box in private gallery 15, please report to the steward's office immediately.
night. She hears only whispers of some quiet conversation. She's coming in 12:30 flight. The moonlit wings reflect the stars that guide me towards salvation. I stopped an old man along the way, hoping to find some old forgotten words or ancient melodies. He turned to me as if to say, "Hurry, boy, it's waiting there for you. As they grow restless, longing for some solitary company. I know that I must do what's right, sure as Kilimanjaro rises like Olympus above the Serengeti. I seek to cure what's deep inside, frightened of this thing that I've become.
You're rolling through the mall with your girls when, bam, you see a mannequin sporting a slamming top and it's hooked up with a blazing miniskirt. Suddenly, you see yourself flossing it to the big game this weekend. You start looking for the ATM. And one of your girls checks you. Honey, that skirt is way too short. That's the kind of skirt you can't sit down in, not without showing all your business. And that could be a problem because you're always sitting in your wheelchair. All because you didn't think you needed a seatbelt just to run out to the store. Then that truck came out of nowhere and whack! If you had only known that most accidents occur close to home, you would have been wearing your seatbelt. And the story wouldn't have gotten all twisted. And you wouldn't have gotten hemmed up. So buckle up. Because you never know.
This message has been brought to you by the Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Here we go.
And now, episode 12 of the Fit Family, who live right down the street in Everytown, USA. Frankie Fit had his checkup today, and Mom and Dad Fit and their neighbor Henry Hardy are talking about the results.
What did the doctor say about Frankie, Mother?
He said his wrists are in great shape, but the rest of him is all soft and flabby.
He said the same thing about Hank Jr.
How could this happen?
Too much Pac-Man and not enough sit-ups.
My Hank's big on sit-downs.
I thought they were taking physical education at school.
Well, they get one period a week of something called general play. The doctor says that's not enough.
Well, what is enough?
Kids should get at least 3 periods a week of vigorous physical activity, but only 1 in 4 are getting that much. Where are you going, dear?
I'm calling the Board of Education. I want the rest of Frankie to be as fit as his wrists.
For more information about physical education in your school, write Fitness, Washington, D.C., 20201. And remember, fitness is for everyone, for life.
Intermission.
WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. Derek Gary. Behind the controls for time travel tonight, filling in for Chris Earle. The blue box has been parked in 1982. I tell you, you could have just spent that summer driving around in your car, sitting on the beach, sitting in your backyard, sitting next to the pool with the radio on, and been pretty happy. You have to spend a lot of money to buy the compilations with all the great 1982 music on them. We start out with A Flock of Seagulls, I Ran, which is a classic. Everybody knows that song. Fleetwood Mac with Hold Me. The Steve Miller Band, Abracadabra. 38 Special with Caught Up in You. Three, like, stadium rock songs because those bands were still around, were still touring. And then we start mixing up a little bit. We heard Toto with Africa, which, according to science, is the greatest song ever recorded. Apparently, it ticks off all the right boxes for exciting the right parts of your brain when you're listening to music, and musicians love it. So, Africa, greatest song of all time? Some people think it is. And we close that out with one of the sadder songs from the summer of 1982, The Motels, with Only the Lonely. We're going to shift gears now and do something very, very special. This is the kind of thing that you never, ever, ever, ever hear on the radio anymore because this was recorded in 1982 and meant to be played in 1982 and never played again. This is Riches and Rubenstein Productions, working for the NBC Young Adult Radio Network. Yeah, that was a thing back in the day, because back in the 1980s, before we had VCRs in every house, before everyone had a CD player and a Walkman and a smartphone and a computer and Facebook and Twitter and all the other things that we waste our time with these days, we had the radio. And if you were a kid growing up in the 80s, you listened to the radio a lot. You owned a radio. There was always a radio around somewhere. People listened to baseball games. People listened to the news. People listened to the top hits of the day every single night. Casey Kasem's American Top 40 every weekend. But also on the weekends, usually on Saturdays and Sundays, you would get these syndicated radio programs that were designed to tell you everything that was going on and get you excited about everything that was going on, because we didn't have the internet. You couldn't just go to some website and say, hey, what's at the movie theater? What's the big film that's coming out this year? What should kids like me be interested in? So to market to America's young people, we had syndicated radio programming. And this is a particularly good example of it. It touches a lot of different styles. You close your eyes and you will, not while you're driving, please, but close your eyes and you will believe you're in 1982. This has everything in it. The old PSAs, the commercials, everything. And the summer of 1982, for those of you who weren't around for it, was actually a pretty significant summer as far as movies go. In fact, I will go as far as to say that one of your top five favorite movies of all time was released during the summer of 1982. And when you hear what's on this record and what they're talking about, remember that nobody knew what these movies were at this point. We had no idea. They looked good. They were made by people that we liked and trusted, but we had no idea how huge they were going to become. So sit back, enjoy. Let's trip back to 1982 and find out what was happening at the box office.
Summertime.
We are nearing the end of a perfect summer, the summer of 82. It's been a season of baseball, boating, surfing, horseback riding, stadium concerts, and just plain getting away from it all. But if you're a Hollywood motion picture producer,
that's a wrap.
You haven't been riding or surfing or swimming this summer. You've been banking. Although people presumably are still engaging in the usual summertime activities, more folks are going to the movies than ever before. In fact, the summer of 82 has literally been a box office bonanza. Over $600 million have been spent at the movies this summer, and that figure is rapidly approaching the $750 million mark. How much is $750 million? Well, it represents some 150 million tickets sold.
Everyone's gone to the movies, now we're alone and left. Everyone's gone to the movies, now we're alone and left.
I'm John Leader, and all summer long, the source has been your ticket to paradise on coming attractions. This just may have been the biggest movie season of all time, filled with such memorable films as E.T., Rocky III, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and The World According to Garp, to name but a few. Movies that help change the way we look at the world and the way we see ourselves. That's why we're so proud to take time out to salute this summer's greatest box office hits. We'll hear from the people who made the movies and relive some classic cinema moments. And not only will we feature the films we've just mentioned, but we'll also cover Poltergeist, The Thing, Blade Runner, Diner, Tron, Night Shift, Firefox, and much, much more. But hold on, because this week we've got a double bill for you as we sneak behind the scenes of one of the final films of summer. It's a love story about a young man becoming a real man. and it'll lift you up where you belong. An Officer and a Gentleman, starring Richard Gere and Deborah Winger. So settle down with a bowl of popcorn and join us, because this is the Source Summer Cinema Spectacular.
Everyone's gone to the movies, now we're alone in bed.
Summer usually begins on June 21st, but this year it began in May. And one of the first feature releases was Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid reunited the two funny men who shamelessly brought us The Jerk, writer-director Carl Reiner and writer's star Steve Martin. It goes without saying that their writing sessions were moments of high hilarity and spontaneous silliness as ideas spewed forth like hot ash from Mount St. Helens.
Judy, is there anybody with any talent out there? Anybody? Writing talent, specifically.
Jenny, send Mark across the street and get us a bag of talent, okay? And bring it in here.
Bring it in.
Listening to Carl Reiner in a more reflective moment, it's obvious they found that bag of talent.
To work with major creative comedy talents is such a wonderful way to live, because what they contribute, they never say, fix it, do something, it's not working. They're saying, how about if? And if you're working with somebody who says, how about if, you've got something to bounce off, something you can say, no, but how about this, or yes.
And perhaps the principal reason they work so well together is, as Steve says, they trust each other.
I have to feel like I can stand up and say the dumbest thing, because sometimes it'll spark somebody else. Right. They go, hey, well, what if? You're really feeding each other, and so you can't have your ego involved at that moment.
What made Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid so funny was that Steve and Carl matched footage from famous films of the 40s with new sequences. So it appeared as if Steve were in the same scenes as, say, Betty Davis.
No hugs, no kisses. We used to flop into each other's arms, Doris.
Well, don't you think we really ought to get to know each other all over again?
And then there was the famous prison scene, bringing Steve Martin and James Cagney together again for the first time.
Guard looks suspicious. Can you act like I'm your ma?
Yeah.
Say something like, no, no, ma, look, listen to me. No, ma, look, listen to me. It's good. Real good.
Hi, I'm Steve Spielberg.
Hi, Steve. You know, Steve is one of millions of moviegoers who rushed to the theater to see this summer's first cinematic epic, Conan the Barbarian, directed by Steve's pal, John Milius, and starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. Steven Spielberg.
When John first previewed Conan for me, I loved it. I just thought it was a great, heroic, old-fashioned adventure, the same kind of movie that I'd watch on Saturday afternoon as a kid, and then go back the next weekend and see the whole thing all over again.
Conan the Barbarian stars 13-time bodybuilding champ Arnold Schwarzenegger, a man whose muscles have muscles. And that fact didn't escape the attention of director John Milius.
Arnold is ideally physically suited for Conan, and once I got to know Arnold, I found that he was ideally mentally suited for it, too. If there was no Arnold Schwarzenegger, we would have had to build one.
Make no mistake about it, Arnold Schwarzenegger is Conan the Barbarian.
I think, yeah, I would have liked living in those days. I mean, especially, you know, right in the middle of the scenes, you know, with all these naked women running around and just not having to pay any attention to social behavior. You know, you just throw the wine in your mouth and have the meat hanging out and just eating like a wild animal.
Speaking of animals.
For the right price, for the right money, and at the right time, I'd even strangle my mother.
Let's call it off.
Oh, come on, it's for charity.
You're wearing your anatomy out for charity. Nobody else does this much for charity.
Bob Hope would.
That's true.
Rocky III. the movie that landed the first KO punch at the box office this summer, bringing in $100 million so far. With two previous hits under his championship belt, Rocky has become thoroughly entrenched in the American consciousness, a realization which still amazes Sylvester Stallone.
People think of me as Rocky and Rocky as me. They're inseparable. Rocky is my shadow, my guardian angel for the rest of my life. It's definitely my symbiotic twin forever. So I just don't fight anymore, and I consider it, a hell of a stroke of luck.
In Rocky III, our hero meets his match in the form of a massive mountain of a man named Clubber, played by Mr. T. Surprisingly, Mr. T had never acted or boxed before.
It was so rough, and I said, wow, this is what it takes to be an actor. I don't think I want to be an actor, it's just so rough. But Sly, he stuck with me and said, take your time, we're throwing a lot of stuff at you at one time. You will learn in 2 months what I learned in 2 years.
It took months of getting him into shape, getting his mind to where he totally believed in the character, and the boxing to where he could actually box several rounds. So when he walked in that ring, everybody in the audience would be afraid because they believed he was invincible. And I think that he makes an incredibly auspicious debut.
Well, here we go. The war is on. We're just waiting for the bell. And here we go.
I just really like the character. Everything I have is because of him. And I felt very sad, and really sad. Even got a little misty when he finished Rocky III. I sure don't want to let go of him, but I guess he's grown up and has to go his own way. I owe everything in the world to him, and I don't know if I'm ever going to find a kind of like an imaginary friend or my alter ego, so I can write so easily about. He kind of like was my therapist, my best friend, my idol, someone to live up to, because I wish I was as ethical as him. And he'll be missed. He really will be missed. So I don't know what's going to replace him. Maybe Son of Rocky.
Final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise.
William Shatner.
It gave hope to people whose background thoughts are always that the end of the world is nigh.
And Leonard Nimoy.
It's an approach which says, in essence, let us be logical, let us reason things out rather than act out on the way we feel about things, and we'll all be better off for it.
Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, along with the crew of the good ship Enterprise, fulfilling the promise in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Watching Star Trek II was like attending a family reunion. In addition to Shatner and Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, James Doohan, Walter Koenig, George Takei, and Nichelle Nichols were all back together again. Older, but wiser.
You're hiding. Hiding behind rules and regulations.
Who am I hiding from?
From yourself, Admiral.
Jim, I'm your doctor, and I'm your friend. Get back your command. Before you really do grow old.
Captain Kirk did come out of hiding at about the same time as his old foe, Khan, played by Ricardo Montalban.
The hell are they?
Admiral, the commander of the Reliant is signaling. He wishes to discuss terms of our surrender.
Khan, you still remember, Admiral. I mean to avenge myself upon you, Admiral. I've deprived your ship of power, and when I swing around, I mean to deprive you of your life.
What I've been doing for so long, Mr. Rourke, and people, when they see me, they say, you know, the plane, the way Tattoo says that, Hervé says that, and then Corinthian leather and Cordova and all these things. I had to be sure that I tried to eradicate from me all that image and this character. That was another consideration that I had to pay close attention to.
Star Trek II had something for everyone this summer. Action, adventure, spills, thrills, comedy, and tragedy. But as William Shatner points out, Star Trek II is first and foremost a film that touches the emotions.
I think that it is a first-rate example of what Star Trek is supposed to be like, and I think the end result will be joy, laughter, and tears.
By now, this should come as no surprise. Spock dies in the end. But listening to Leonard Nimoy talk about the project, you get the feeling that the Vulcan just might be revived for Star Trek III.
I think there are a lot of elements come together that form a total chemistry that works, and that chemistry is called Star Trek.
Captain's log, Stardate 8141.6. Starship Enterprise departing for SETI Alpha 5 to pick up the crew of USS Reliant. All is well. And yet I can't help wondering about the friend I leave behind. There are always possibilities, Spock said. And if Genesis is indeed life from death, I must return to this place again.
Nothing can cool you off quicker during a long hot summer than a good chiller. John Carpenter, the demon director who gave us Halloween and The Fog, shocked us again this summer with The Thing, starring Kurt Russell.
This is U.S. Station 31. Do you read me? Found something in the ice. We need some help down here. Can anybody hear me? We found something.
What makes The Thing so terrifying is the disgusting way in which the monster can go from one body to another. It's just John Carpenter's way of having fun.
It's really impossible to photograph it because it's never any one thing at any one time. It's constantly changing, so it has no original form.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to, but it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's won.
Hi, I'm Steve Spielberg.
Welcome back, Steve. If John Carpenter's The Thing didn't grab you, then Steven Spielberg's Poltergeist probably did. On the set, Steven was the master of the macabre.
And this stuff all works as long as the audience can find some logic for it. You know, that's why I wanted to do that. Just that little transition from the ghost at the top of the stairs to just for a moment the beast. Ghost stories usually avoid seeing ghosts. And when they do see ghosts, they're three-dimensional and they're real people. I thought, well, this is a real golden opportunity to do a spirit coming down the stairs for the first time. This thing is growing out of her, and it's getting larger and larger, and the shoulders are almost going up to the ceiling. Just when you begin to see the fingers, it goes...
Steven Spielberg.
I just sort of based the lifestyle on a lifestyle I'm familiar with growing up in suburban Phoenix, Arizona, in tract homes with cul-de-sacs and two-car garages, and this suburban lifestyle breeds a certain kind of individual.
And one kind of individual suburbia breeds is the kind that makes friends with extraterrestrials. As we'll learn when The Source Summer Cinema Spectacular, featuring an officer and a gentleman, continues.
We're blazing all sorts of new trails.
In the last known photograph of the Dalton gang, Bob and Grat Dalton are both wearing Levi's original blue jeans. We'd like to think they gave their choice a lot of thought. After all, there wasn't a more honest, hard-working pair of jeans a man could wear. And there wasn't any place in the state of Oklahoma you couldn't wear them. But the Daltons probably had other things on their mind. 100 years later, we're still giving you a lot not to think about. Like no-nonsense workmanship that'll never let you down. Comfort you know you can count on, and style that fits in without question, whether you're into state-of-the-art, state college, or just the state of Oklahoma. Levi's jeans. The more you think about them, the more you realize you don't have to.
Levi's, the legend lives on. Levi's, the legend lives on.
It's hungry for work. It's a truck that gives you the feeling that it's hungry for work. The Toyota Diesel. Built a diesel from the ground up. With a true diesel engine for quieter operation, quicker starting, and reliability. Yeah, it's hungry for work, but it's not thirsty for fuel. 38 EPA estimated highway, 31 EPA estimated MPG. Remember, use this 31 estimated MPG for comparisons. The actual mileage you get may be different. Actual highway mileage will probably be less than the EPA highway estimate, not available in California. Now you can sum up the feeling about the Toyota Diesel. Somebody did it right.
Oh, 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 what a feeling.
And that's a great feeling, to know something is working for you.
Toyota.
This is WMFO Medford. We're in 1982, time travelers.
The Source Summer Cinema Spectacular, featuring an officer and a gentleman, continues now with the one movie that absolutely everybody loves.
Hi, I'm Steve Spielberg.
Good to have you back, Steven. 1982 has indeed been a Spielberg summer, first with Poltergeist, then with E.T. E.T. lives, especially at the box office, where it is nearing $200 million in only 2 months of release, and it's on its way to becoming the biggest motion picture of all time. But interestingly enough, Steven didn't set out to make a blockbuster.
Well, I'm consciously aware of the existence of the public when I make my movies, but then it has to be good for me too. But I really feel that I don't pander and I don't design. I don't sit in a room and say, this movie is going to be everything the public has ever wanted because I know where the nerves are. I know how to push the buttons. Every time I make a movie and it's a big hit, I'm surprised.
Steven Spielberg shouldn't have been surprised. After all, he's the most successful director of our time. The man who's given us Jaws, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, 1941, and Raiders of the Lost Ark. But in a sense, E.T.'s unprecedented popularity is surprising because it's the most personal movie Steven's ever made.
I went through a divorce in my household, and the movie begins with a young child who has only a mother. Very recently, the father left for Mexico with another woman and has left the family to fend for themselves and to get over the trauma of separation. And I've been through that divorce, and it meant a lot to me when I was 14 years old and growing up in a household that was in turmoil. So that side of the question, Elliot in the movie, in E.T., is having trouble accepting his father's absence. So when this creature comes to this planet and needs help and needs to get home and needs Elliot, Elliot suddenly steps into his father's shoes, somewhat symbolically, to become the adult in that relationship. Even though the creature's 900 years old and Elliot's only 10 or 11, Elliot has to be responsible and has to save the day. He has to be our hero. Although there are wonderful special effects in the movie, and certainly the E.T. himself is a marvel of modern wizardry and film, beyond that, it's a very, very personal story, scratching the surface of, you know, a more personal side to the movies I've been making.
Do you talk? You know, talk.